Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Gray Matter. Well, you will not sense this because the shows have kept coming out. We've had an archive of recorded shows, and Devin has done a great job of keeping them coming. However, I have been away from the show for a while, and in the meantime, there's been some changes. And Devin has been very busy. One of them you noticed is the change in the music. As much as we love the song stylings of the late, great LGBTQ artist George Michael, the good people at Sony came out and said, you can't use that song anymore. So what we decided to do, Devin was experimenting with some different samples, and I went back to the tried and true, which is classical music. And so we have bookended the show with, of course, a piece from Bach at the end, and the beginning is a concerto from Mozart. And so, by way of explanation, classical music was a really huge part of my education as a boy. My mother exposed me to it. Just as a personal story, we didn't have a lot of money growing up, but there was a promotion at Safeway, of all places, whereby my mother, if she bought a certain amount of groceries, she'd get a free LP, a record album, 33 and a third, for those of you who remember those. And these were from the great composers. And my mother collected these religiously, and she played them constantly. And so this was part of my upbringing. And I'm so grateful for that, because I was exposed to really the greatest music ever written. And of course, Mozart is part of that. I'll also share with you one of my favorite movies, if you have not seen it, is Amadeus. It was an Academy Award-winning film, I believe from 1984. It won a number of Academy Awards. I've watched it probably 25 times. If you have not seen it yet, you must see it. I think it's free on YouTube. So that's the explanation for the change in the music. We hope that you enjoy it. The second thing I wanted to talk about is we have merchandise. Devin has been working very hard. So if you go to the website, we have hoodies and other stuff. So if you're interested in that, and Devin deserves all the credit for this, he's designed them himself and done all the work. And of course, being a lawyer, I'm here to take credit for everybody else's hard work. It's in our DNA. Finally, I just wanted to say a thank you to everyone who reached out to me over the past little while. People like our guest today know that I've gone through a bit of a difficult time recently. Things like illness and injury and death and tragedy come to all families. And unfortunately, my family has been visited with this recently. And a member of our family left us. That was a very, very difficult. And also, my father has been in hospital, is still in hospital, doing better. So I took a little bit of time away from the show. I just wanted to say thank you to everyone who reached out to me and to my family and expressed support and prayed for us, including our guest, David Leese, who I've wanted to have on the show for a very long time. He's a good friend, a wonderful man, and he is very involved in a number of different things, but especially the Frontier Center for Public Policy. Friends of the show, those of you who watch us avidly and listen to us, know that we had Peter Hawley on the program, he was just an excellent guest. David Leese is sort of the, let's say, left brain, right brain, but David Leese is my understanding, is more involved in let's say the execution arm of what the Frontier Center for Public Policy does, so I'm looking forward to a very, very stimulating conversation with him. Introduce him in a moment, but he knows because he watches the show, we have to do something first, and we have to go to the quotations board. And of course, As always, these are selected in the guest's honor. I know David a little bit better than most of our guests, and so hopefully these are meaningful to him. The first one is somebody that he knows, and I have to say I'm a little bit envious. And the author of this quotation is a person who's on my list of dream guests, as is David. Conrad Black is quoted as saying, "A quest for knowledge is not a war with faith. Spirituality is not usually an infelicitous amalgam of superstition and philistinism, and moral relativism taken outside midfield leads inexorably both to heresy and to secular wickedness, which are often identical. If that has you reaching for your thesaurus, then mission accomplished." The next one is from a former great general, the hero of World War II, and also one of the better presidents that the United States had in the 20th century, Dwight D. Eisenhower, who wrote that an intellectual is a man who takes more words than necessary to tell more than he knows. And finally, someone else whom David and I both admire very much, in my opinion, one of the greatest public intellectuals in the world right now, certainly one of the top Canadian ones, Jordan Peterson, Dr. Jordan Peterson. He said that if you cannot bring peace to your household, how dare you try to rule a city? Okay, so who do we have on the show? Well, David Leese. He is the Vice President of Development and Engagement for the Frontier Center of Public Policy. He's a longtime supporter of the center's mission. He is passionate in his role about inviting and engaging a strong national community in support of the mission of the Frontier. He believes strongly in the importance of good public policy for the benefit of the lives of all Canadians. He has served in a variety of senior leadership roles within industry, government, First Nations, and education. David studied at Waterloo, Ryerson, Toronto, and undertook his master's in public policy at Queen's University. David also served as a director of communications and donor relations at the Mennonite Central Committee of Canada. He has extensive experience in leading fundraising and development within higher education. And also was involved in successfully raising over $7 million for a business school endowment fund. And during his time at Red River, that is the Canadian Mennonite University, he served as Vice President of Business Development and was involved in the establishment of an endowment fund for a chair in construction management. He's raised many millions of dollars in various projects when he was there. He has a BA from the University of Waterloo, Master of Public Administration from Queen's University, and a Certificate in Development from Ryerson University. So here he is, woefully overeducated. But we're so glad to have him here. And David, I have to, first of all, apologize to you because of the scheduling snafus that prevented you from getting here sooner. I'm so happy you're here. Welcome to Gray Matter.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, and it's an honor to have another discussion with you, Leighton. And I know it's been a trying time with you and your family, but I really like the opening, by the way. It makes our hearts
sing. I knew you would. You know, that horn, you know, it's there aren't a lot of really great pieces in classical music with that horn, and just the way it comes in, it just it makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up. So where do you want to begin? You know what, I want to start with this. This is a bit of a, I don't want to put you on the spot, but if this were a quiz show, I want you to tell me in three guesses or less who the author of this quotation is. This is from a recent famous book that I don't think many people read, which is a pity. And it goes like this: at least 4 billion useless eaters shall be eliminated by the year 2050 by means of limited wars, organized epidemics of fatal rapid acting diseases and starvation. Energy, food, and water shall be kept at subsistence levels for the non-elite, starting with the white populations of Western Europe and North America, and then spreading to other races. The population of Canada, Western Europe, and the United States will be decimated more rapidly than on other continents until the world's population reaches a manageable level of 1 billion, of which 500 million will consist of Chinese and Japanese races selected because they are people who've been regimented for centuries and who are accustomed to obeying authority without question. And incidentally, from that same book comes the heinous term essential worker. Can you guess, David, the author of that terrible book?
Oh my, this sounds like a trick question. And I used to be a faithful participant on Reach for the Top. So
Me too.
A very interesting quotation. It rings such a familiar tone. And it can't be George Orwell, although it sounds Orwellian. But I think it's someone remarkably recent. Is it from Maurice Strong or something like that?
Well, I'll give you a hint. He was born in Germany in 1938, and he is head of a much vaunted organization.
I didn't know that Klaus Schwab was born in Germany.
That is from the Great Reset. Isn't that awful?
Isn't that brutal?
It's like the Mein Kampf of the 21st century. But I mean, look at that. It's talking about the extermination, the extirpation of one eighth of the world's present population. Mm-hmm. And it's so fascinating because it's frightening. It's horrifying because all the things that are happening, the reason why I opened it with it, is all the things that I want to talk to you about, or at least many of them, are mentioned right there in that quotation. Epidemics, attacks on energy, food supply, water, starvation, it's all there. And
it's really a dystopian future, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's happening. A lot of the stuff is happening right here, right now, isn't it?
You know, it really is. And it's almost like it's hard to believe the different moving parts that are happening now on that kind of global front. And I think just a few years ago, one would be accused of having a tinfoil hat, quite frankly, for kind of making those kinds of assertions. But the reality is that as those kinds of policy plays are being revealed, they really reflect a mindset, a mm-hmm. culture, a group of people who are clearly on a different page than we are.
Mm-hmm. And so your role, part of your role at the Frontier Center for Public Policy is to create awareness about some of these things that are happening. How did you first become involved with the Frontier Center, David?
Well, you know, it's a really neat question. Years ago, I saw a column in the Winnipeg Free Press when it was a newspaper. It's hard to believe it actually, you know, had a lot of really good content in it, yeah. I thought, and perspectives and voices. That certainly isn't the case now. But when you looked at the Winnipeg Free Press, and I think I moved to Winnipeg in 2003, really had kind of an extraordinary opportunity to be involved in the establishment of a university at the time. And, you know, and so I was, you know, just looking at the newspaper and I saw this column by Peter Hawley, and I was intrigued by it because I would really identify myself as a kind of a classical liberal. I liked how the column, if memory serves me correctly, was really identifying themes around empowering people, empowering citizens, and helping government to perform better. And I was, I had worked in, as you kind of alluded to in the introduction, in a number of sectors, including the private sector, but I was also a mayor of a municipality, and all those things were very good experiences. But these are themes that are very important to me to help build a better society. And I know that sounds really cheesy, but it's true. And so I just to track Peter down, and we had coffee, and then kind of became friends ever since then. And that's where I was just so impressed that there was this team of people who really cared enough about Canadians and about society that they would dare to speak about not only those themes, but do it in a nonpartisan way and talk about these things that are important to making Canada better.
Mm-hmm. I had the same experience with the Frontier Center. When I went through my cancel culture experience, which I've talked about a fair bit on the show a couple of years ago, Peter Hawley was one of the people who reached out to me.
I remember
and,
that.
Yes, and it was so gratifying and frankly a tremendous relief to know that there was somebody out there who actually wanted to talk to me because I was speaking public heresy.
Exactly.
And I'm so
glad. And I do recall that conversation saying, you know what, we really need to reach out to this guy. What's his name again? Oh, yeah, Leighton Gray. Because, you know, it's very difficult on people, both in their minds and their spirit, you know, emotionally, when people are attacked ad hominem. They don't want to talk about the real content of the argument or the debate, but it's the classic head fake and logical fallacy, right? You don't attack the discussion or the content, you go after the person. And I just, we really felt badly for you. So that's why we observed this and we said, we need to reach out to him.
Yeah. Well, and I accepted your pity gratefully and it was welcomed into the Frontier Center family and the rest is history. You know, I plug the Frontier Center all the time. It's just it's an absolute treasure trove of information. I just pray to God that Bill C-11 doesn't destroy it. Try and mow down every other piece of truth that's on the internet.
Exactly. And it's a sad day when you really do have governments leading with control and really undermining the role of citizens. When citizens can't freely discuss issues and try to search for the truth because they care about their fellow citizens, then you're in deep trouble. And, you know, it's frankly outrageous. And so we need to fight that actively. And that's part of the reason why I, you know, try to work so hard at Frontier, as well as with yourself and so many other people. It's an amazing network of people right across the country and frankly around the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, and part of the work that you're doing, and it's a bit painful for me to mention this, is your own podcast. And I say painful because, you know, I have not received my invitation to appear on that program yet. but I'd like you to talk about your podcast because I researched and you've had some just incredible guests on there and content. You want to talk about your own podcast a little bit, how, you know, sort of the genesis of it and what the work that you're doing with it?
Certainly. Well, it's called Leaders on the Frontier, and Leighton Gray is certainly on the list. it's kind of an opportunity to talk with people who are really exercising leadership, we think, in a really positive way on a whole host of topics, policy areas that really make a difference in people's lives in Canada. So whether it's energy policy or the whole area of the management of COVID-19, when we look at areas related to history, understanding that related to, say, Aboriginal policy, and there's just a host of areas. And so we've been very fortunate to be able to, you know, just open up that kind of discussion with those people affiliated with Frontier and beyond as well. And what I find is it's just such a great format like this one to have a conversation covering kind of key questions that I think a lot of people are frankly confused about or want to understand what's the real story, given the kind of limitations of kind of legacy media. And it's amazing the kind of appetite that people have to learn, like what's really going on and how do we guide those discussions with good, solid policy principles.
So a few of these topics, David, if you don't mind diving into them a little bit, that I looked at and I found that were discussed on your podcast are of great interest to me, and I think to our viewers and listeners. One of them is the concept of healthcare. This is something that you've examined in some detail. One of them is the basic health question of who owns our bodies. Mm. You want to talk about that a little bit? Because this is something that, of course, is very relevant in the work that we're doing at my firm. As you know, a lot of the vaccine mandate cases are centered around the question of informed consent you know, can a government, can an employer mandate and tell people what they will put in their bodies? But you went a level deeper and you examined this question of who owns our bodies. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Okay. Well, what a profound question. I think the answer is you own your body. And this is part and parcel of really 10 key principles of classical liberalism. It enables freedom. It's just common sense that you were born into this world free. And part of that freedom is that you own your body. Mm-hmm. And so with the state intervening is really a profound discussion and decision. And part of what we believe is that it's very important to have very minimal coercion in our society. We envision a society that is based on cooperation and working together that respects individual rights and freedoms. And as part of that is the ownership of your body. And this is really one of the foundational parts of our society and our culture. And I think that when you intrude on that, then this raises huge red flags regarding, frankly, the emergence of a tyrannical state, tyrannical power. And so it's in that context that we also come across the whole topic of healthcare. Mm-hmm. How do you best create a healthcare system that cares for people? And so one of the foremost things about that is, I mean, if you think of being an adult, let alone a child, you want to ensure that people are empowered to look after their own health. And in Canada, that's truly a mixed bag. We have really a socialist, highly underperforming system for many reasons. Canadians have kind of bought into this illusion that Canada has a really great healthcare system. The facts are that we don't.
Michael Moore might have fed that illusion in one of his films.
Sorry, what's that?
I don't know if you saw the Michael Moore film. It was called Sicko.
Oh, yes, right.
Yeah.
No, and it's so sad because we have incredibly gifted people, caring people that are captured in this system. And for really almost ideological reasons, we don't innovate. And I can talk about that in extensive detail. And that's certainly been one of the things that I studied in my graduate studies for years, is this underperforming healthcare system. Like, just to put it into perspective, Leighton, you have, the facts are that Canada has one of the most expensive healthcare systems in the world, the second by any measure. And secondly, on any international index, in fact, a number of years ago, Frontier used to partner with a Swedish think tank on this very question. And on most indexes, we are truly at the bottom of the OECD countries, the famous 32. And so a lot of Canadians are just not aware of this. And it's so sad because it's like we kind of pride ourselves and have even been sold into the idea that somehow this is part of our identity. And I think this is really quite a tragedy, that we have literally 4 to 5 million people on waiting lists in pain, in great pain, and chronic pain does incredible things to people's lives that hurt those individuals, their families, their communities. It even undermines our productivity if you think of it through an economist lens. But it's not a caring system. It's ill-designed. And the bizarre thing is that it really puts patients in crisis. And that's why that debate is important. And it begs the issue then around the assumptions of the people that are leading this system. Who is serving whom? Are they serving patients and Canadians with care and compassion? Or are they serving, quite frankly, an ideology? And if you just look at that for a moment and bear with me, it's a profound discussion. And the irony is also that in many ways, the decision makers around moving out of this system and becoming more like, say, France or Germany, where they have a mixed system of both public and private. Like, why would you not do that if the objective is about serving people? So the irony to this is that the decision makers, namely MPs and judges, don't use our public system. And the public doesn't know this. It's kind of like an Animal Farm situation where people are more equal, in quotes, than others. So they end up serving these other kind of, they end up getting their care in other clinics, like elite athletes. When an elite athlete, like say on a football team gets injured, they don't sit on the waiting list, do they? No, of course not. They get care right away and in these wonderful clinics. And it's the same thing with our MPs and judges. So these people are truly in a bubble and they don't experience the pain that Canadians are feeling. And there's this book that we came out with recently called Patients in Crisis by Susan Martinuk, one of our senior fellows, did a marvelous job, including telling the stories of these people. And, you know, it's unbelievable. Actually, one of the persons that her story was told was one of my friends, Mark. He had been on a waiting list. He was caught with a debilitating pain in his shoulder. And the specialist said, you know what, Mark, the problem is this. This is the dilemma. You will not have this solved for 2 years. But in the meantime, as you sit on that 2-year waiting list, unfortunately, this is going to seize up and then we won't be able to save you. So he said, the way out of this is you need to go across the country to the Canby Clinic in Vancouver. And he did. And within 2 weeks, he had the operation. He said he's never had better healthcare. Now, surely that's putting the needs of the patient first rather than the needs of some kind of ideology that presumes that your body doesn't really matter. Your health doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. How cruel is that?
It is very cruel. You mentioned Animal Farm. Made me think of the paragraph in the book where the pigs are addressing the other. Of course, it's an allegory for those who haven't read it. George Orwell, I think it's his best book, actually. But the pigs are addressing the other animals in the farmyard, and they're saying, well, you know, we don't eat these good apples and drink this delicious milk for ourselves, comrades. Oh no, we're doing this for you, but we are the brain people. We must have the best food so we can make all these decisions for you. But you know, speaking about this ideology, I discovered this myself actually when I was working on the Ingram case in Alberta, and I was looking into preparing for the cross-examination of Dr. Hinshaw, Chief Medical Officer of Health here. And I discovered to my horror, once I drilled down deeply enough, this policy upon which our failing healthcare system is based. And of course, it proves the Winston Churchill adage, you know, that sociology is the ideology of, socialism is the ideology of failure, because at bottom, I discovered that our healthcare system is being run according to things like health equity and social justice.
Right. Yes.
And I just read a book recently by Dr. Thomas Sowell, who I know you admire as well, called Cosmic Justice. And it's quite a remarkable book because it was published in 1999, but he foresaw all of this. And it's just incredible. But it really begs the question, and this is the next one I want to go into, is, okay, what do all lives matter in public policy? Kind of picking up your point, do all lives matter? I got in trouble for, I got in trouble for reposting a message to African American podcasters. They put out something and they said all lives matter, and I reposted that, and I got roasted for saying that all lives matter. I had the temerity to say that. So, David, tell me, in public policy, do all lives matter?
Yes, they should. Yes, definitely. And it's a very profound foundation to the brilliance of, frankly, Western civilization has been the recognition that all lives matter and that we are equal and that no one is above the rule of law. And frankly, no one is beneath the rule of law either. And so this is seen as one of the frankly, foundational principles of our society. And it's been a consensus until, I would say, recently, there are these cracks developing that are very, very concerning, where we have an attack, frankly, on the rule of law, which basically is a perversion of the principle that all lives are equal. And it's being perverted for many reasons, not the least of which is it's a power game. If you think of, I don't know if you've studied lawfare, but that is an intentional weaponization of the law against your political opponent, namely to criminalize them and put them in jail. And that is happening, and that is extremely concerning and should be of it's frankly an outrage. When we think of the treatment of a peaceful protester named Tamara Lynch, as an example, you take out your opponent not by engaging in debate or discussion or evidence or the facts of the matter, you go after them through process. And this is quite well developed, this strategy. I remember studying it for years. I'm a bit of an odd duck looking at some of these things over the years, but this is a long history. And if you're interested, look at the another think tank, which is called the Brookings Institution, which has an extensive background on lawfare. And this is what's happening. That's part of what the issues, you know, is going on. And then you have the other side, which is also attacking it, which is ideologically based, not power based, which is really based on another think tank, which was called the Frankfurt School, which mm-hmm. so many people would be familiar with, where, you know, you had, you know, and I've studied all these people too much almost, but people such as ultimately Marcuse and Theodore Adorno and the like. But mm-hmm. this is all about inverting those basic assumptions and foundations to create really measures of hate among groups between the so-called oppressor and oppressed, so that we can have a new socialist utopia all in the name of progress. And this is horrific, because they ultimately see individuals, to paraphrase Ayn Rand, as chattel that will be punished by the state and used to their means. The ends justify the means. So the individuals become fodder. And this is profoundly, I would characterize as the Rubicon of our civilization. If we do not respect the rights of the individual, if we put aside basic debate and freedom of discussion based on evidence and facts, then we have left the Enlightenment. We have mm-hmm. become really subservient to the masters that are in charge according to their games of power and their twisted notions, a la Klaus Schwab, and your beginning quote of the mm-hmm. future.
Mm-hmm. So this issue of the rule of law is a really interesting one, David. I know is central to the work that the Frontier Center is doing. Mm-hmm. We're seeing the erosion of the rule of law. One of the things that I happen to believe is that the rule of law exists. It's really something that's unique, I think, to the English system of law, and it grows out of the common law, and of course, is traced back. Most people trace it back to the Magna Carta of 1215. But my question for you is: can the rule of law exist in a society that is fundamentally atheist? In other words, how is a ruler, a Machiavellian prince, or a prime minister going to be held to the law, to the same legal standard as everyone else, unless there is some, unless that person is beholden to some higher power, or at least some higher standard of moral and ethical behavior? Is that possible? Is it incoherent to suggest that we can have a functioning rule of law in a society that's fundamentally atheist?
What a profound question. The fundamental answer would be that it is incoherent. However, it does not mean that atheists cannot thrive within the social contract if there's a consensus on the value that none of us are above the law, in the sense that many of us would believe in natural law. And there's many definitions. If we look over the last 4,000 years, We can see the emergence and definitions of natural law. If we look at, say Cicero and Seneca to the history to from Plato to, you know, the whole lineage to John Locke and Adam Smith and so forth. But the bottom line is this: we look at a society to a higher wisdom, call it common sense, from a divine being, God, some of us would call, refer to God, but we defer to a respect for a law that is above us, that is inherently evident. So we presume freedom as an example. We are born free. We were not born slaves. And we can get into all the nuances of how natural law has been interpreted through history, and in fact, even how slavery came into being. But we do know this, that the presumption of natural law or truth is vital for our civilization. We do not presume that we can suddenly become a different sex because we wish it. Truth is not just simply arbitrary or what we in so much postmodern culture believe is relative. We actually believe there is truth. And I hope we would believe this as we enter into an aircraft and we look to a pilot to ensure that they know the truth of direction and elevation so that we can survive and live. I mean, surely this is evident to anyone with any common sense. And yet there's a full frontal attack then on that foundation. And this is going to be disastrous for, frankly, our ability to go forward and to be able to ultimately cooperate and move society forward.
It really comes back to this essential question is of what is the value of human life too, doesn't it? I'm thinking in the context of, for example, right now, it's been very topical in the news about what's been happening at children's hospitals in the United States, specifically in Boston, where we're learning that children there are being treated at a very young age, are being given experimental drugs and being mutilated, being exposed to surgeries such as hysterectomies and mastectomies. And so it begs the question, okay, what is the sanctity of human life? You brought up the point about once we accept a certain lie, which is that, for example, that a man can be a woman, that opens up a corridor, a pathway to further lies, and then who knows what is possible. It reminds one of what Solzhenitsyn wrote about in the Gulag Archipelago, about the Soviet system, was just to build on a fabric of lies. You know, they know they're lying, we know they're lying, and so on and so on. Yeah. So how do we escape this web of lies, David? How do we get back to some semblance of truth and reality so that we have a more coherent society, a civil society, you know, the kind that Hobbes wrote we should avoid?
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. I would say the short answer would be a renewal. Yeah. I think that in many respects, we have taken for granted a lot of the foundational principles that frankly, many don't even have a hot clue about or an appreciation for. They've become empty rhetoric rather than an intentional teaching and exploration of those principles. So the area of natural law as an example would, I think, is a good case in point, where in the world of natural law, we would say we have a deep appreciation, respect for kind of timeless principles that have given order to our society. So, for example, a respect for our parents. Now, we know that not all parents are perfect. None of us are. But if there is generally a respect for parents and the role of parents, that should be reflected in the order and law of society. And so when a child enters a children's hospital with a presumption that they're getting care, and this should all be done with the full consent of the parent. And yet we know that within that system now, that is under attack. And certainly within the school system, it's astounding in Canada, the sleight of hand that's being used by the administrative state to basically say, no, the parent is really not important. It's the state. And the state is personified by the educational bureaucracy, and we will guide the child's learning, not the parent. And this is a total inversion of not only our civic society, but really natural law. Natural law would say, as common sense, is that I am the parent and I am in charge ultimately of my child's education and their health and well-being, period. And the state is gone beyond the bounds, and it's gone beyond the vision of a limited high-functioning government to one that is dysfunctional. And this is so presumptuous, Leighton, because we look at why would any caring person look to the state with all its flawed actors? I've worked at a senior level in states. I've been, you know, involved in so many respects. You know, the state is a wonderful gift and opportunity to bring limited order to society, but it has to be looked at in very pragmatic, practical terms. And so if you care about people, you realize it's the limits of government. Government can't rule everything, and nor was it intended to. And so it almost becomes, it reminds me of, you mentioned Machiavelli. Machiavelli's piece was seminal, The Prince, because he basically was talking about how during this time, how do we legitimize the almost divine right of the prince to do whatever they want? Mm-hmm. And so this is absurd. We believe in the presumption of freedom and that people ultimately should be in charge of their own lives within the bounds of a covenant, an understanding of rules, so that people can plan their lives and be creative, energetic, and innovative, and we can build a society second to none. And that is antithetical to this whole ethos of people who just want to plan everything. They think that somehow it's incredibly presumptuous that somehow the state can plan our lives completely mm-hmm. and enable things to go from truth to falsehood, and that we can somehow just suddenly change people's gender mm-hmm. is just poppycock. And it's something mm-hmm. that obviously you'd get from the bowels of some university.
Mm-hmm.
It's nuts.
It seems to me, though, that you mentioned the educational system. The legal system has been just as guilty of doing this. These are the two key sort of weaponizing influences that seem to be doing a lot of the damage. I've got another bit of a quotation here from a man named Carl Sagan, who you'll know well.
I met him, actually.
Yeah, did you? Wow.
I did.
Right before he died, he wrote something that I want to mention to you. I want to get you to comment on it. He was talking about the United States. He said, when the United States is a service and information economy, when nearly all the key manufacturing industries have slipped away to other countries, when mm-hmm. awesome technological powers in the hands of a very few and no one representing the public interest can even grasp the issues, when the people have lost the ability to set their own agendas or knowledgeably question those in authority, when clutching our crystals and nervously consulting our horoscopes, our critical fact faculties in decline, unable to distinguish between what feels good and what's true, we slide almost without noticing back into superstition and darkness. And I want to connect that with something else that is happening right now in Europe. Because of the Ukraine war, there are people, many German people, who are going out into the woods to chop down trees. The Black Forest is being chopped down because people need to burn wood for fuel. There's going to be the Western Europe, which has been for centuries perhaps the most advanced civilization in the history of mankind, is descending back into feudalism. Because of these disastrous policies that Carl Sagan was talking about. What's going on, David? Why is this happening, and who's doing it?
Well, to be blunt, there's a full frontal attack on energy, among other things, in our world right now. It's named as a war on fossil fuels. And I would say that that battle is also being waged based on false policies that mathematically do not work. So, for instance, the irony is that there's a couple things that you need to know. That is that the demand for fossil fuels continues to increase and has never been higher. And often it's almost like in a North American bubble in Europe, we think that somehow that's not happening. No, the demand for fossil fuels has never been higher. And the double irony is that the so-called green industry is not green. It's all based systematically on fossil fuels like solar energy and wind. And so the real transition will ultimately happen when the marginal cost of finding more oil and gas is so high that it just is not economical anymore. And that's where it begs the question, when do we move to say something like nuclear or fusion or what have you? But the transition is not to wind and solar because it doesn't meet basic criteria of affordability, dependability, reliability, and security, as illustrated now by the invasion of Russia into Ukraine. So these are what I would refer to as dead-end policy. They have no viable future. And yet, in the name of both a constellation of ideology, people who really believe this is the path to utopia, and a combination of power politics, where there's a host of groups, including a impertinent 13-year-old, or I don't even know how old Greta Thunberg is, who says, "How dare you," at every meeting. But you know what I'm getting at is that there's a constellation of actors that politicians always want to appease. And this is something that people should not underestimate. Politicians, and they're very special people, and they have very difficult roles. And we, you know, are constantly trying to figure out how do we support them. But they're in difficult roles where they often do not have, how do I put this diplomatically? They don't have any courage because they're just trying to seek people's votes to make, you know, to be in power. They're trying to appease certain interests. And the special interests are very good at constantly knocking on those politicians' door, where the silent majority are busy with doing what? Trying to do their lives. So what's happened is you have these confluence of forces coming together where energy inflation in Europe has really just begun. And this is going to be a disaster for Europe. It's an incredible opportunity as well for Canada, quite frankly, as we think about.
Can you tell our Prime Minister that?
I wish I could. I wish I could. But yes, indeed. Yeah, no, this is absurd. Why? How is the Prime Minister, articulating the idea that somehow there's no business case to export LNG, liquefied natural gas, to Germany or the rest of Europe is absurd. I mean, the irony is, has he ever prepared a business plan? This is a good question. So what I'm getting at is that the world is very much embedded into the world of fossil fuels. So the question is, if we care about the environment, ironically, we would want to develop those resources well and ethically. If we look at natural gas as an example, that is one of the cleanest forms of fuel that we could promote, and Canada has lots of it. We should be the energy superpower of the world, leading the way with our fellow Canadians of Indigenous background, developing this for the benefit of everybody. I mean, it's horrendous. The money that we leave on the table is truly an opportunity to change our standard of living. If we, like, we only have, Canadians really don't, they take us for granted every day, but we only have one customer for oil and gas now. It's called the United States. And as a result, we when we sell that product, we sell it at a discount, and it's a variable number. It's dynamic as the market changes, as you know. But we leave behind literally hundreds of billions of dollars on the table. So we've got to get that product to Tidewater. We've got to seal the deal with Europe. We can supply them with reliable, affordable, dependable energy. And the tragedy is this is going to hurt people. You're going to see this winter, and hopefully it's a mild winter, but you know, statistically, it's going to be a situation where, unfortunately, there's going to be people who are choosing between eating, and then you have all that inflation on food, heating their home, and surviving. And we know well-documented cases of thousands of people that have died because of energy. People freeze to death in their home. And that's just totally unacceptable. How would any caring, compassionate nation or policy decision maker allow that to happen? And I think, anyways, I've tried to summarize the confluence of events, Leighton, but this is what's happening. And it doesn't need to be. I mean, I think that whole Nord Stream project, you know, shipping, building a lot of the European economy, let alone the German one, on Russian gas was always absurd. We always knew that there was a risk that that would be shut off, like they did with the Ukrainians, 15, 20 years ago? They showed that they could not be a reliable partner. So why would you get in bed with that? Is beyond me.
No, it is shocking. And of course, it's not mentioned that cold kills 7 times more people than heat does.
Yeah,
that's globally. Right. But, you know, as you were talking, I was thinking about your friend, Lord Conrad Black's book, The Canadian Manifesto.
That's right.
And in it, it's a very optimistic vision for Canada. It describes a vision for Canada which has our best days ahead of us if the right decisions are made. And
exactly.
The decisions are the ones like the ones that you were talking about. But we have to part of it is we have to disabuse our minds of this whole climate hysteria, this climate hoax, which, as you say, I think quite accurately, is really just repackaged red communism. But I want to switch gears a little bit, David, and come back to the environmental issue. And I want to get you to talk about a project or an endeavor that the Frontier Center is involved in, involving Mr. Preston Manning, who was a guest on our show. He was here. He's wonderful, as usual. But he's been very involved in a project that perhaps you could talk about, and also perhaps talk a little bit about an important event that's upcoming in Winnipeg at which Mr. Manning is going to appear and speak. Would you like to talk a little bit about, about that?
Yeah. Preston Manning has been a great friend of Frontier, as so many others, including just so many persons. But Preston Manning, we were honored to publish with him a very interesting piece. It's kind of like a fictional story in the aftermath of the truck convoys and the concerns, you know, raised about.
I call it a thought experiment.
Yes, a thought experiment. Yes, indeed. But I would encourage people to read that. It's really kind of an inspiring take on it. And I mean, the perspective is also grounded in Preston Manning's experience and insight on kind of prairie populism. It's almost like every 20 years or so, the grasslands get dry enough and then there's some spark. And, you know, years ago, you know, you think of 1986, as I recall, there was, pardon me, the tendering of the procurement of the fighter aircraft project. And and as I recall, Bristol Aerospace submitted the proposal. It was both technically superior and it was cheaper than the other one. And yet the government of the day gave it to a Montreal-based aerospace supplier. But regardless, these things really have a way of kind of cycling over of populism. And I think the question he posited was, well, what do we learn from the management of COVID-19? And what if there was a springboard of populism that basically said this could be a renewal of the federal government, that instead of, you know, like as a mayor, I guess we had protesters too. I would just invite them in for tea or coffee and listen and ask them questions and see that as an opportunity. But our government didn't do that. It was just the opposite. It was almost an intentional strategy of vilification and the cynical use of wedge politics. So in this case, we really have the strategic question in light of everything that's happened. How do we rebuild Canada? How do we rebuild Canada? Canada is an incredible country. And I'm very proud to be a Canadian. I know you are too. And there's precious things that we have at stake in our country. We've got everything going for us, geography, resources, but the people are incredible. Sometimes I wonder about our culture, but regardless, we've got to rebuild our country. So that's the topic for a luncheon event on September 22nd in Winnipeg. We expect several hundred people to be there. And Preston will be overviewing that question, saying, where are we at now? Where do we need to go? How do we move forward? And inviting that kind of discussion. At Frontier, we're always honored to really keep it focused on how do we build a better country for Canadians. And I think right now, a common theme I get from people is people like us are always going to say, you know what, it's not so much about us now, our generation, it's about the next generation. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we need to view this, the lens that we need to look at it through. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very exciting opportunity.
Mm-hmm. I should have mentioned off the top of the show, but I am wearing my Frontier Center t-shirt, which says that if bad ideas are hard to kill.
Neat.
And in that vein, let's talk a little bit more about you know, sort of the climate hysteria, which is driving something else that the Frontier Center has been talking about in some of the articles. And that is recently on a Thinker's Corner, the question was asked, will Alberta stay or go?
Mm.
And of course, this is very connected to the whole environmental policy, which is connected to the federal government's energy policy, which of course is driving Western alienation. And it's become, it's reached a point where people out West, particularly in Alberta, are embittered. They're angry. Recently, the deputy prime minister was called an expletive. She was yelled at. People are angry, and we're finding out that apparently she was here because she was looking into expansion of the territory of the caribou, which appears to be a surreptitious way of restricting northern oil and gas exploration in Alberta. What would the people at the Frontier say in terms of those of us who love Canada? What would they say to Alberta about whether or not Canada can be saved based upon, I would say, the predatory and discriminatory actions of the Liberal federal government?
Well, there's so many angles to this, but the short answer is this. I can't imagine the amount of rage, not only within Alberta, but many other provinces, quite frankly, where our federal system is not serving provinces equally well.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a huge problem and challenge, and it's also an opportunity. First off the bat, our federal system is blessed with a lot of delegated power to the provincial level and then ultimately to local government, which is a very good policy of subsidiarity. We would say at Frontier, it's important to move services as close to the people as possible. Instead, we've had a federal government over the years that has frankly moved and manipulated the system, our federal system, to really benefit their political aspirations. And I think it's frankly tended to serve the province of Quebec over against provinces such as Alberta. Because if you look at the data, it is profound. It's not just a dysfunctional equalization payment system, right, that creates an outflow from provinces such as Alberta, Saskatchewan, BC would be another one, into other, quote, have-not provinces. It's all the other money through federal programs and services, which are incredible. And I think certainly one of our friends at Frontiers, Tom Flanagan, he's documented this well with others. So be sure to look at that and keep that into perspective. So the federal system is not fair. It's not fair in terms of the way it's functioning, and it needs to be brought into the 21st century. And I would say that I chuckle at this in some measure because, I've seen the media analysis regarding the leader, the premier of Quebec, and his genius of pursuing kind of an aggressive nationalism, surprise, surprise. And it's almost like separation by stealth. And yet I see the criticism of the so-called sovereignty proposal by Daniel Smith. And I'm not, I have not examined it closely enough to really kind of offer or some type of analysis there. But the criticism of that is somehow being inappropriate. And I say, no, it's what's good for the goose is good for the gander here. Surely.
That's what she's saying. She's saying that Alberta should act more like Quebec.
Yeah, absolutely. Any rational actor would. And I remember going through graduate studies and we used game theory, including, kind of like prisoner dilemma scenarios on these exact scenarios. And if any rational person was somehow in Ottawa or any of these provincial actors, they would lay out the board mathematically and they would say, well, any rational actor is going to pursue this type of separation arrangement. It's not because they particularly enjoy, the machinations of getting into these kinds of gritty debates and things like that, but it's because they're rational. Like, this is not serving Albertans. And I would go one step further. We're missing the whole point, and that is that these systems do not serve all Canadians. When we provide a equalization system that gives huge amounts of money, ultimately, to my beloved province, Manitoba, as one example, we really enable the growth and size of a state, namely the province, to be much bigger than almost any other province, with the exception of Quebec. Mm-hmm. So we're creating a culture, again, that is creating a large state, right? Because those politicians, as they get those kind of, quote, windfall revenues, are going to use them for political purposes. And that's exactly what's happened, is that the system is being politicized in a way that is actually not serving Canadians in the long term, by creating a culture that is more and more dependent on the state, more and more emphasizing that every solution is somehow the state. No, it isn't. It should be our community. It should be individuals working together as a team. Mm-hmm. And this is frankly outrageous. And I think that what I'm most disappointed with is we can't have that. We're having this discussion now, but we should be having recognition, thoughtful recognition of that fact and reality, and saying, wow, it's totally unacceptable that somebody uses foul language to attack a minister of the crown. But by the same token, why are they doing that? How that is a symptom Mm-hmm. of the root cause of these issues. And that's wrong. Yeah. I'm not condoning that behavior, but I'm just saying that's the context. And surely we should be saying, wow, of course they're angry, because we're not serving those people. And that's mm-hmm. what is very upsetting.
When you talk about game theory, for those of us who played Risk as kids, it feels
yes.
Albertans a little bit like we're trapped in Australia.
Right.
But for anybody who's played that game, was trapped in Australia and come back and won, the game's not over.
Yes.
Coming back to though this concept of that you were describing, where we have debate, one of the things that's most concerning is the lack of that. And even on the political level, when Brian Peckford was here, he talked about how the way that our political system functions has changed from the time when he was in politics. And for example, it was announced recently, although Parliament is set to come back, they've extended this these COVID conditions. So we're going to have a limited Parliament now, again, going on 3 years. And it appears to me, it seems to me obvious that this is by design, that this government does not want to have debates. They do not want to have bills like C-11 questioned. And this goes against coming back to the concept of the rule of law. This is central to the rule of law.
It is.
That our legislators under representative democracy will flesh out the best ideas, sort of strongest steel is forged and hottest fire. But this is not possible. This government talks about diversity, but there's no diversity of ideas. For them, that's a monolith. That's, as you said, it's an ideology. So how do we get back to a more functional democracy at sort of at the legislature and parliamentary level in Canada? Is there a path forward for that?
There is. First off the bat, we need to understand what's going on. We all need to be very much aware of how bad this is and its very real impacts on Canadians in the short term and long term. And we need to call it out, and we need to invite people to action. Calling your elected official is extremely important. I've said to so many people, unless you're in the face of these decision makers, you don't matter. And, you know, as an elected official myself, I really appreciated when people would write me a letter or call me, because you get that kind of feedback and you don't want to pander to just a few voices, but you want to keep perspective on the issues and really be in touch with that kind of feedback. That's important, that people be heard. Otherwise, what are you doing? You're just cornering them, and bad things happen when people don't feel heard. That's what's going on. But more to the point, you have a situation where it is a tyrannical use of power. I think historically of, if you know, I'm trying to remember them all, but John Locke's treatise on government define very well the five markers of a tyrannical state. And I think that those were reflected in Jefferson's primary drafting of the Declaration of Independence, where he called out the notion that if a state power, at that time was George III, was basically doing end runs around Parliament, end runs around having representation, that is tyrannical. Like, you have to respect the rule of law, which also means those institutions of the voice of the people. We serve the people, and that they've got it all wrong. They think we're here to serve the state, and the state, these guys got it all wrong. They think it's about serving, themselves, having the people serve the state. So it's all been inverted, and this is wrong, and we need to call this out and come to grips with it. And I think that the whole limits and control of speech is not only terrible for Canadians in the immediate, it's terrible in the long term. We limit good ideas. The heart of innovation in society comes from free-flowing debate and discussion. And often we recognize humbly that truth is sometimes at the margin, not at the center. Right? So yes, we'll make decisions using the majority in the interim, but we do so humbly, with the realization that we also want to be listening carefully to those other minority voices. And that's true diversity. It's not some superficial measure of diversity based on your color of your skin or whatever. It's based on, I believe, Martin Luther King Jr.'s quotation that surely we judge people not based on the color of their skin, but the content of their character, right? So this is the world that we're entering in, where they're undermining these institutions of democracy, but they're undermining this culture of graceful respect for each other. It's almost, and why is that? Because they are bringing in an immoral political operation, right? When you use lawfare, you are using an immoral political tactic and strategy. And secondly, many of them are also inserting an ideology which goes beyond the bounds of our current civil society. If I used an analogy, it'd be like being on a soccer pitch. We have the genius of our civil society is that we may not agree with each other, but we're still playing the game. We know what the rules are. We have the referees. They're managing the game in a way that we don't kill each other. We don't have violence. As soon as you start bringing these foreign ideologies that don't believe in those basic assumptions of the rule of law, the danger is that all bets are off. That's when people get really angry to a point where it becomes, if you use scenarios of games theory, then you get into a problem where you get into violence. And this is the breakdown of civil society that we're starting to see, I believe. And I hope I'm wrong, but this is a risk.
I was reading something recently that's applicable to this concept of the rule of law, David. It's a very old treatise, 15th century treatise by someone named Lord Fortescue.
Yes.
And of course, he's little known, but actually a lot of his writings have found their way into constitutional systems. For example, I know that the American Confederation fathers, the drafters of their constitution, looked to Lord Fortescue. It's a very fascinating book because it's framed in terms of a conversation between the Lord Chancellor of England and a prince who's going to become king. One of the questions in the book is, okay, what makes England different from countries like France in terms of this rule of law? And the answer comes in two things. Number one, that the king is beholden to Parliament.
Correct.
That was different. So again, that strikes at one of the problems that's going on in Canada, is that our king, our ruler, is no longer beholden to Parliament.
That's right. And that's one of the definitions of tyrannical government.
Right. And the second distinction, and he was comparing England to France. In England, there was the common law, the law of the common people, which is more than just law. It's really a repository, a well of everything of importance, culturally, politically, even religiously and morally, to a society, to a group of people. And that common law, wherever it's gone in the world, and say what you like about white supremacy or whatever, but wherever the common law, the British common law, has gone, people has historically have been free, more free than they've ever been, and more prosperous than any people have ever been. So my question to you is this. In terms of looking to a way forward for Canada, should we perhaps be looking to the past and trying to recapture some of these ideas? Look at some of the ways, some of the things, some of the concepts, some of the ideas, some of the traditions that made us different, that made us free, made us prosperous. What do you think about that?
Absolutely. The principles of classical liberalism, I believe, offer us an extraordinary opportunity to renew our society. I think that we need to be very intentional on nurturing that culture. I was always taught by my parents that one of the important strengths of any family, let alone group or country, is respectful candor. And that's all set within those timeless principles, quite frankly, of toleration, of tolerance, and understanding others' points of view, having free and open discussion, presuming freedom, minimizing coercion by the state, having a limited state, being very respectful of private property. You know, the list goes on. And that is a timeless wisdom. And I think what we would do well to do is to be very ambitious as a country to renew those principles in our educational system. Instead of spending time on the bizarre ideology of wokeism and cultural Marxism, we should not only be teaching those skills, but also citizenship. And part of that includes an appreciation of that history, Leighton. There's no doubt about it. And, you know, what I appreciated, I was with my family to the UK just recently and had an extraordinary visit, sightseeing, but also meetings. And it was fascinating, you know, that appreciation for how unique that culture of freedom was within particularly the United Kingdom out of the Anglo-Saxon period of history, combined with many heartfelt battles and the, you know, the English revolutions were in very much contrast to the revolutions that happened in France that were really from a very different type of tradition. So I think that's very special and unique, and within the kind of the Anglosphere of Commonwealth countries to varying degrees, but particularly Canada in our case, has been passed that torch of freedom and of classical liberalism, and that we should not take for granted. And I would dare say, I would challenge so many of our decision makers whether they even have a basic understanding of that history. And that's a very humbling question to all of us. And I think we need to renew in that history, as you said.
I understand also when you were in England, you met our mutual friend, Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, friend of the show. Well, we have we've kept you for quite a while, David, and we're very grateful for your time.
Well, thank
you. We could go on and on talking about all kinds of things, but I think that we do have to turn to the part of the show that we call the reading list. And so there's a couple that I have here, and then I'm going to turn to you. One of them is one of the Frontier Center's books. This is a one called In Praise of Dangerous Universities and Other Essays by a man named Mark Mercer.
Very good.
Do you want to talk about that one a little bit?
Well, I think it's a marvelous book that is really challenging universities to be universities, places of vigorous debate and discussion, and not some monoculture wokeism that we see so commonly in Canadian universities. It's a real tragedy. So I think that that's a very insightful book, and I really recommend it to people to get a better glimpse of how we really need to renew those institutions. And if not, they frankly need to be defunded.
Yeah. So that one is available. Where would people find that book if they wanted to get their hands on it? Can they order it through the website?
They can find it on Amazon.
Okay, great. So the other book I want to mention, and we've talked about this sort of, or you have talked about this sort of obliquely today, at least this topic. It's called The Diversity Delusion. It's by a brilliant lady, an American lady named Heather McDonald. And she's written this book within the last couple of years. And the description is that America and Canada, too, is in crisis from the university to the workplace. Toxic ideas first spread by higher education, as you mentioned, David. And these have undermined humanistic values, fueled intolerance, and widened divisions in our larger culture. Chaucer, Shakespeare, and Milton, oppressive. American history, tyranny. Professors correcting grammar and spelling, or employers hiring by merit, racist and sexist. Students emerge into the working world believing that human beings are defined by their skin color, gender, and sexual preference, and that oppression based on these characteristics is the Western experience. Speech that challenges these campus orthodoxies is silenced with brute force. And so this book argues that the root of this problem is the belief and endemic racism and sexism, a belief that has engendered metastasizing diversity, bureaucracy in society and academia. Diversity commissars denounce meritocratic standards as discriminatory, enforce hiring quotas, and teach students and adults alike to think of themselves as perpetual victims. From Me Too Mania that blurs flirtations with criminal acts, to implicit bias and diversity and compliance training that sees racism in every interaction, Heather McDonald argues that we are creating a nation of narrowed minds, primed for grievance, and that we're putting our competitive edge at risk. One of the reasons why I really like this book is she very, very astutely recognizes and identifies the source of these problems, but she also provides in the book some ways, some solutions some way out of this diversity delusion. So those are the two that I mentioned. David, I know that you're an avid reader. You have a lot of books off to your right there. So do you have some suggestions for the people who have been taking in this podcast in terms of furthering their understanding, their knowledge of some of the topics that you've been talking to us about today?
Yeah, you bet. Well, one of them is, I could recommend so many, but I would certainly recommend Susan Martinuk's book out of the Frontier Center called Patience in Crisis. I think it's a very thoughtful analysis, and it's frankly quite moving as well, about the need to reform our healthcare system for the sake of Canadians. So I would recommend that. And there's kind of a series of books I've been reading that are fascinating. But, you know, when I went to the UK, I visited what was called the Adam Smith Institute. It's one of our sister think tanks in the UK, as well as the Institute for Economic Affairs. It was kind of Margaret Thatcher's think tank of sorts. But it was really quite inspiring. But they gave me a gift, which was called, it's a DVD.
Oh, wow.
So I'm responding to the book with a DVD. And it's called The Secrets of the Magna Carta. And it's narrated by certainly one of the actors that I certainly appreciate. His name is Hugh Bonneville. And so he's from Downton Abbey fame, but that's a wonderful DVD, and basically says the most valuable piece of paper in the world, a legendary document of almost mystical power. The two-part series explores the strange history of Magna Carta and its enduring power, namely that the people are ultimately in charge and no one is above the rule of law, including the king.
Wonderful. Great. Thanks so much, David. It's been an absolute pleasure having you here.
It's been an honor.
I would be remiss if I didn't do a shout out to your lovely daughter, Sophia, who did some wonderful research for our firm this summer. I'm very grateful to her. Thank you so much for being our guest, David, and best of luck in all of your future endeavors with the Frontier Center.
Thank you, Leighton. It's been a delight to chat with you.